Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. Welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, mapping the experiences of an artist running in Phoenix while female, and trying to gauge the color of the night sky. But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
Both of these campaigns decided they were going to go the policy polite route. And it just so happened that both of them chose that in the rock, paper, scissors, and we got what we got, which was a pretty civil policy debate.
I think 22 years is pretty good. It's a retirement age. Not that I'm abandoning what I do now, but that it's time for someone else, and it's time for somebody younger.
It's becoming damned if you do, damned if you don't, simply because people want to jump on conspiracy bandwagons, and they want all the answers before the analysis has been done.
We don't know anything about these people, right? We have only the vaguest information on them. We're heading into a high-stakes election, and we'd kind of like to know, like, who they are.
Harris is getting somewhere between 10 and 12% of Republican crossover vote, and that's really hurting Trump's ability to gain a lead in the state.
I just think it's important that, you know, election officials across the country who are tempted to do exactly what Peggy Judd and Tom Crosby were doing in Cochise County know that we are watching. That is the most important message.
And joining me to talk about the upcoming retirement of a longtime Arizona congressman, the Arizona connections to Jack Smith's new court filing in the case against former President Trump, and more, our former state school superintendent Jaime Molera with the firm Molera Alvarez. Good morning, Jaime.
Good morning.
And former congressional staffer Roy Herrera. Roy, good morning to you.
Good morning. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to both of you. So, Roy, let me start with you on this new, around 120,000 more voters now found to not have provided proof of citizenship when registering to vote due to a computer glitch with the Motor Vehicle Division. The first, we thought that there was the, you know, just sort of the first round, about 98,000, but now there's a lot more. What are the implications of this, do you think, both practically and sort of, I don't want to say philosophically, but sort of in the perception of people?
Well, I mean, so it would have been better, obviously, if the entire population had been announced at once, right? That would have been cleaner. But from my understanding is that this new population is exactly situated as the prior population, the prior approximately 90,000 people. So these are individuals who have not shown proof of citizenship due to that MVD glitch, but are, you know, full ballot voters, meaning they can vote for, you know, federal, state, and local candidates. Mm-hmm. And of course, when this the issue was discovered originally, I think the governor, the secretary of state, and the attorney general did the right thing in that they went to court. They went to the state Supreme Court to get some judicial and some legal certainty about this. And then the court found that these folks should remain on the ballot as full ballot voters. So this new tranche of people, while it's unfortunate it came out later, are the same type of people, and they are going to be allowed to have the same voting rights, you know, the same ability to vote full ballot. Now, obviously, there'll be some conspiracy theorists that will probably, you know, use this to their own ends. But I think what is important to sort of point out is in that litigation, the litigation before the state Supreme Court, you had Republicans and Republican-leaning groups argue to the court that these folks, these individuals who have not provided proof of citizenship at all, should remain as full ballot voters. So I'll repeat, Republicans and Republican-leaning groups argued that these folks who have not provided proof of citizenship should be remaining on the ballot or remaining on the voter rolls, excuse me. So it'll be interesting. Now, one might say there's a little bit of hypocrisy there because it's probably because of the fact that, you know, this population leans Republican. But that is the position that the Republicans took, and that's something that should be remembered.
Jaime, do you anticipate that the state GOP will take the same or have the same kind of feeling about this group? I mean, they've called for Secretary Fontes to resign over this.
So I'm a little bit surprised that Roy is shocked that there's politics going on in an election in the presidential election year. No, I think they're going to, of course, they're going to continue to do that. And of course, they're going to continue to make this a political issue. But one of the things, as Roy pointed out, there were more Republicans in this list than there were Democrats. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, they want to allow them to vote. But they're also going to use the political leverage of saying, see, they're allowing possibly all these people that are non-citizens the ability to vote. The only trouble I have with how this rolled out is I think that the governor and the secretary of state in particular should have been more aggressive in making this public and putting this out there. Because, you know, getting, for instance, the Speaker of the House and President of the Senate and including them in these discussions about what is happening and how we're trying to fix this thing. But there wasn't a lot of that kind of communications. It's been very insular, and it's been, of course, through the court process. But I think the problem with this is that it surprised a lot of people. A lot of folks were like, well, wait a minute, what's going on here? And so that's why that kind of outreach to the public is so critical, but we just didn't see that.
Do you think that this will, as Roy alluded to, lead to more conspiracy theories and maybe diminish people's faith in what the results of the election actually are?
Well, of course, in certain sectors, absolutely it will. Let's just be honest about that. But if there is a game plan on how to roll this out, how to fix this going forward, then I think that starts to minimize it. And I think the conspiracy theories will always be in those little corners of the state where they're regardless of what happens and what people say or what the data says, they're always going to be talking about conspiracies. But if it's managed in a way that's public, that has the confidence of, you know, business organizations, political organizations saying, yeah, this makes a lot of sense, then I think you can mitigate that quite a bit. And the other thing is that the star cards now that people need to have, that's
the travel ID.
Exactly. Yeah. As that starts to, is being mandated now that you have to have it by next year, I think that starts to mitigate it too, because a lot of folks, you're going to need to show your passport or something that says you're a citizen in order to get that. So all of those things combined, I think will start to lessen this issue.
Roy, I'm curious what you make of the lawsuit filed by Strong Communities Foundation of Arizona, a Republican-aligned group, trying to get the names of these 200-some-odd thousand voters. The Secretary of State's office is saying, we can't give it to you. We don't have it quite yet, and we won't have it before the election. The Secretary of State's office also say they're concerned that this will lead to harassment and intimidation of voters.
Well, it's that latter point, I think, that's pretty concerning to me that the Secretary is pointing out is, you know, what is the purpose for this list? Why do you want it? And we obviously have concerns giving out this list to third parties who may try to contact these voters and in some instances may, you know, try to harass these voters. And so I think that's a rightful concern that the Secretary of State has. Now, about whether, you know, they have the list already or need, you know, time to produce it or whatever, I don't know the actual answer to that. But I think that it should be a question here in this litigation is why exactly does this group, who is this group, and why exactly does this group want that list?
Jaime, I want to ask you about the court filing unsealed this week from special counsel Jack Smith in the 2020 election case against former President Trump. You talked about Roy being shocked before. We should all be shocked, right, that there's an Arizona connection to this, right? There's never an Arizona connection to any of these national election-related stories.
No, of course not. Well, it's pretty damning, let's be honest. And I think President Trump now realizes that he probably has to win in order to avoid a lot of the consequences that might fall out from this special counsel's report. So it's interesting that in Arizona, you know, we were at the heart of that, right? We were in the eye of the storm. Governor Ducey was getting calls by President Trump.
Some very publicly, yeah.
That's right. His ringtone had hailed to the chief, yeah. And it was playing while he was giving a press conference. So, yes, I think it will have implications, but I think people's, as far as how it's going to impact the election, I'm not sure. I'm not so sure it is, because the folks that really believe that President Trump's a criminal, they believe that already. Those that believe that it's fake news and this is yet another liberal attempt to get at President Trump, they're going to believe that already. It's going to be interesting to see that very small percentage of Americans or Arizonans, how they're going to tip, and if this is going to make an impact on them.
Well, Roy, it's interesting, and there's been, you know, this is not something that I'm coming up with. A lot of folks have said that one of the interesting differences between Kamala Harris's campaign and President Biden's is that Harris is spending less time sort of talking about former President Trump as an existential threat to democracy, spending a little less time talking about things like January 6th and attempts to overturn the election. To Jaime's point, there's sort of that middle group of people who are undecided, persuadable, whatever word you want to use. Is something like this, especially in a place like Arizona, is something like this usable by the Democrats, by the Harris campaign, to try to convince voters who are maybe on the fence that they shouldn't vote for Trump and should vote for her?
Well, starting with the Jack Smith filing, you know, the ties to Arizona, what was specifically stated in there, and this is something that also is not particularly shocking, is that in the instances that Arizona's referenced with Ducey and others, you know, it had to do with sort of allegations that Trump was making and then a response for a request for evidence, right? Like, well, what's the evidence for this particular fraud that you're saying? And the passage about Doug Ducey was interesting to me because he asked for the evidence and they never got back to him, right? Mm-hmm. And so what's not shocking to me is that the Trump campaign in 2020 couldn't find any evidence of any kind of fraud in Arizona or anywhere else. And so going into this election cycle, this presidential election, I am reminded of the moment in the vice presidential debate between Waltz and Vance when Waltz asked him whether Trump had won or not in 2020, and Vance couldn't answer the question. And of course, that was immediately cut into an ad by the Harris campaign, a very effective ad, I think. So I still think that it is an issue to many voters in Arizona and elsewhere. Because you have a candidate on the other side in Trump that still refuses to acknowledge that he lost in 2020 and continues to, you know, put out these conspiracy theories, these allegations without evidence related to election fraud.
Is there any chance you think we're going to see Doug Ducey testifying? If assuming this goes to court, do either of you think there's a chance that someone like Doug Ducey would testify?
I think he'll try and avoid it like the plague if he ever wants to. Getting back into politics, and I'm sure that at some point he probably will. So I think he'd want to stay away from this as much as possible.
Roy, what do you think?
I think he would totally want to stay away from it as much as possible, whether it happens or not. I mean, this is going to be so complicated by the immunity decision with the U.S. Supreme Court and sort of how things proceed. But I'm sure he will try to avoid it as much as possible.
He'll have a previous engagement that day or exactly. Something like that. Roy, I want to start with you. Raul Grijalva, a Southern Arizona congressman, longtime Arizona congressman, says, assuming he wins this time, this term will be his last. Is it surprising to you at all that he would decide to call it quits after this next term? Again, assuming he wins. I mean, he's had some health issues recently. He's not, you know, he's not old, but he's not a young guy either.
It's a little bit surprising. I mean, this is someone I've known for decades now as a friend of mine, someone that I've admired for a long time. And with him, you always kind of felt like, well, this guy's just going to keep going, you know, for forever. So I was a little bit surprised. But of course, the health issues, the age, you know, at some point, sometime, you know, people want to get on with their lives and that kind of thing. So I'm not surprised in that sense. But, you know, he's going to have big shoes to fill. I'm sure there's going to be multiple people down there that are very interested since that seat hasn't been opened for a very, very long time. But the thing is if Democrats take the majority in the House, which it seems like they will nationally, he's going to go back to his chairmanship of natural resources for his last 2 years. And I'm sure he's going to, you know, do the best he can as kind of his swan song before he leaves.
Where would you place the over-under on the number of Democratic candidates getting into that primary, an open congressional seat in a safe Democratic district?
Yeah, I mean, you're going to probably a half dozen to begin with, at least, right? Okay. I mean, you know, obviously his daughter, Adelita Grijalva, is a Pima County supervisor down there.
Right.
You're going to have Regina Romero, the mayor. You know, there's probably some legislators that are going to be interested. So I think you're going to be in that sort of half dozen or so candidates to just begin with.
Jaime, would this be, obviously, as I mentioned, it's a pretty safe Democratic district. And with a longtime incumbent, it makes it even more difficult. But with him leaving, does that open the door a little bit for Republicans if they field the right candidate to maybe have a chance there?
So he represents where I grew up in Nogales. And I just want to say I am not running for that seat.
Come on.
Not the news we were expecting you to make today.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
There's still time, though. You still got 2 years.
I don't think a Republican has any chance whatsoever in that district. I mean, it's just so heavily skewed Democrat. But Roy's right. I think the over-under, in my opinion, is probably going to be 10.
Wow.
Because those are the kinds of seats that come along once in a lifetime. If you're able to win and catch lightning in the bottle, then you're there for at least the 22 years that Grijalva has been there. So I just, even with redistricting, you're still going to have a very strong district in that area. So that's why I think it's going to be Democrat and it's going to stay Democrat for a long, long time.
All right. So, guys, I usually say this when I'm about to talk about a poll, which is that, you know, we recognize polls are snapshots in time. There have been a lot of polls recently about all sorts of races. But I want to ask you both about one specifically from High Ground, an Arizona-based firm. We have their pollster, Paul Bentz, on the news cap frequently. This showed that Vice President Kamala Harris is leading former President Trump in Harris, Vice President Trump in Arizona, 47.6% to 45.5%, so about a 1-point difference. What I want to ask you, though, about is that it also showed that Harris is winning about 12% of Republican voters, whereas Trump is getting about 1.7% of Democratic voters. I mean, is that a significant thing that double-digit numbers of Republican voters say they're going to vote for the Democratic candidate?
Well, I'd want to look at the crosstabs, but I would assume that a lot of those Republican voters are Republican women.
Mm.
Republican women that are aligned with pro-choice policies. So that's been one of the schisms. And I've said this on this program a couple of times before. The Republicans need to focus on the two issues that benefit them. And I think Vice President Vance, prospective Vice President Vance, did a good job of talking about the border and talking about the economy. When you talk about these other issues, it takes away from that. And if you noticed, all the Democrats are talking about is the pro-choice issue, because that is that schism within the Republican Party, and again, with Republican women by and large. So the more that if they can stay on message, Republicans, then that helps them quite a bit. But if they allow the discussion to move to other areas and they're not talking about those things that sell, then they're going to have a tough time I up and down the line.
Yeah, Roy, how significant do you think it is? I mean, we saw, for example, the Harris campaign. I think Vice President Harris herself was campaigning with Liz Cheney in Wisconsin. We saw former U.S. Senator Jeff Flake, a Republican from Arizona, endorse Kamala Harris late last week. Are these like, is this an area where the Harris campaign can maybe have some benefit at an election that a lot of people think is going to be sort of won on the margins?
Absolutely. I mean, in prior statewide campaigns I've been involved in, you know, data people have told me to win statewide as a Democrat in Arizona, you need to get at least 10% of the Republican vote, right? And then also win independents. And I don't know if that's true. I'm not a data person, but that's sort of back of the envelope what's always been expressed to me, that you need to get to at least 10%. And if you see, you know, folks that have been Democrats that have been wildly successful at the statewide level, like Senator Kelly, for example, he's done well north of that and done pretty well. So if Harris in that poll is up by, you know, 12 or 13 points, she's exactly where she needs to be as far as winning what will be a narrow race either way, right? Statewide. And I think to your point, I mean, she's been able to tout the support of a lot of people that I think do matter to at least a segment of the Republican electorate. You mentioned Jeff Flake. You know, obviously the outreach to the LDS community has been significant. Mayor Giles has also been an endorser there. And then, of course, there's Liz Cheney. But then also you've got members of the McCain family. And in Arizona in particular, I think that, you know, has a lot of weight, has a lot of power, and will help her. Now, on the issues, I completely agree with Jaime that, you know, probably the best issue for the Democrats among Republican suburban women in particular, which could be part of that 10%, is the issue of choice and reproductive rights. And, of course, there's going to be a ballot measure, you know, that's going to enshrine that in the Constitution. So these are things that I think the Democrats can take advantage of and run on going forward to get the necessary Republican support.
Jaime, do you think someone like Jeff Flake matters in this election? I mean, there's been so much talk about, you know, the idea of like giving Republicans almost permission to vote for a Democrat. And we saw that some 2 years ago in the governor's race and other statewide election races. Is that a legitimate thing, do you think?
I agree at the margins. I mean, Jeff Flake has also, remember, been a part of the Biden administration.
Right, Ambassador to Turkey. Yeah.
And so that tends to, I think, minimize a little bit his impact on Republicans. But certainly, it's a problem for the Republican candidates that these folks, and Mayor Giles is a good example of that, jumping ship and giving credence to allowing to vote for Harris. But again, it goes back to my point. If the Trump campaign stays on message, and that's been the problem of President Trump, of being able to stay on message, and Republicans nationally are bemoaning that. They're saying they loved what Vance did because they believe he's a great messenger. Allowing him to be more front and center is going to be better for Arizona Republicans. And that's why you're going to see him coming to the state, I think, a lot more, is for that reason. I think he carries the message of the border security and the economy in a much more impactful way.
So we saw that this poll obviously had Vice President Harris up by a point or so. Been a lot of polls that show either Vice President Harris up by a few, former President Trump up by a few. I think the biggest one I saw was maybe 5 points. One of them was up. Do both of you still imagine this is going to be a really tight election, maybe even tighter than 4 years ago when President Biden won by, what, like 10,000 votes? Jaime, do you think that?
I think it's going to be extremely tight because there's still a lot of angst in Arizona over inflation and the economy. And every poll that I've seen, those still dominate the discussion. Reproductive rights is going to be a big issue, but I think that that can be somewhat jujitsued by the Republicans because they're saying, well, look, there's an initiative that's going to be dealing with that. So you can vote on that, but then come back home and vote for the Republican policies that will deal with the economy, that will deal with border security.
So maybe conceding the proposition.
Well, certainly a lot of the Center for Arizona Policy is not going to concede anything on that. But Republicans really haven't been talking about it. They haven't been saying, I'm going to be against this initiative. If you noticed a lot of the rhetoric that's out there and the campaigns that are out there, they're not talking about it. So the smart ones are going to be really focused on those two issues that I've mentioned.
Roy, about 45 seconds. Do you anticipate this is going to be a super close race for president here again?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know if it can get closer than 10,000 votes, but it's going to be close. And, you know, on things like democracy, reproductive rights, obviously there's headwinds for the Democrats. And then I think also, you know, the Democrats are doing what they need to do and taking on the other issues like the economy and pointing out, you know, that there are good aspects, many good aspects of this economy, particularly in Arizona. And then, of course, we recently saw Vice President Harris go to the border and talk about the fact that she supported this bipartisan border security bill that Trump torpedoed for his own political ends. So that's the kind of thing that we're all going to be talking about for the next 30-some days, but it's going to be extremely, extremely tight.
All right. Roy Herrera, Jaime Molera, thanks you both for coming in. I appreciate the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, what color is the night sky? The answer is complicated. But first, Phoenix artist Jen Erso has a thing for maps, but she's always wanted something more out of them than you'd normally get.
The ones I liked the most were the ones that were showing me something that I would see, like, on the ground. Mm. You know, I don't want to look at, like we don't look at things in our world from an aerial view. We experience everything on the ground. And I was interested in something more, you know, more than just a popular landmark like the Statue of Liberty. Like, I want to know about, like, the other little cool things that you can find and, like, how do you do it?
The maps she makes reflect not just the streets and landmarks, but memories, experiences that happened there, the good and the bad. And last year, she made one that struck a nerve. It's called A Guide to Running While Female in Central Phoenix. At first, it looks like a hand-drawn map of Central Phoenix. But look closer, and there's a lot of memories buried in it. And a reality that Erso discovered most of the men in her life knew nothing about. She talked about that with my co-host, Lauren Gilger.
I had been talking a lot with my partner about, you know, experience of running, and realized in our conversation how much he didn't realize, like, what my experience was like versus his as a guy. Hmm. He was saying, you know, I love running at night in our neighborhood because it's nice and dark and quiet and nobody's there. And I'm like, that's precisely why I don't run in our neighborhood at night. I'm like, I stick to main streets. I do this. And I had also told him about an experience of going down this one street where this guy was always hassling me, you know, like, you know, yelling crude things at me. And so I just started to avoid that street. And he was like, well, that's not great because that's like altering your behavior. And I said, what do you think it's like every day? You know, like when I go run, I'm thinking about all of these things.
Wow.
You know, how I dress, what time I go, how populated is it? Is it a weekend? Is it a weekday? You know, I'm constantly thinking of all these different aspects before I step out the door.
Wow.
For my own safety. Mm-hmm. As somebody who's been running for now, God, I just turned 50, so I've been running for 37 years.
Wow. You know? Yeah. Always a factor, and a lot of different factors. Okay. So this is radio, so you have to talk about what this looks like a little bit because people can't see it. It's a map of Central Phoenix, right? Like around where you live and where you run. And there are symbols on it, like there are on many maps, but they're not kind of your average symbols. You've got bright lights, little sunshines, right? Like little kind of megaphone things. You've got one that's a little sports bra with a circle around it that's crossed out. So decode this for us. What are you describing?
So I was thinking of the different routes that I would take, and there were three things that stood out to me. It was like, where would I run only in the daylight? Mm-hmm. You know, where is it not safe to run at night? So a lot of that's like, I would never run on the canal at night. Mm. I don't care how lit they make it and how pretty they make it. Like, it's not an option. Mm-hmm. The little megaphone thing was places I remember being catcalled. Mm. And that's like remembered. It doesn't mean like those are all the places that I was gonna, like, I was surely catcalled and honked at many other times.
The ones you can recall, yeah.
Like the ones that were especially egregious. Yeah. And then the other one is a sports bra with a line through it. Was when I think about, like, I'm so hot, I just want to, like, run in my sports bra. But I know as soon as I take it off, there's, like, this transition where now I know I'm going to get honked at. Like, it's like I'm making myself open to it. And I've had moments where, like, I've been out running, no honking at all, and then the shirt comes off and I'm just in a sports bra, and then I get honked at or yelled at.
Immediately.
Yeah.
Wow. So talk about your own experiences in this. Like, it sounds like this is not, like, a great thing for you. Like, you've been running for a long time and running for a long time in Phoenix, but it's challenging. Like, I run a lot in the city as well. Does it ruin it for you? Like, I'm curious that you still do it, right?
I love running, and I love just the feeling of that my body can take me, you know, this long distance. And right now I'm training for a 50K, and it's like trying to imagine myself in a space, like, traveling that amount of, you know, those miles is incredible. There have been a lot of negative things that have happened to me in my life, and it's never, like, stopped me from doing the thing that I love to do. It's almost like, well, how can I overcome this, and how can I figure out a way to do it where I can still enjoy it? And, you know, would I like to go run on a trail by myself and feel safe? I would love that, but I'm not going to do it. Mm-hmm. But, oh, God, I don't know. Why do I still do it? Like, I couldn't not do it. And I would say, you know, 90% of the time, it's not like, you know, you're not getting harassed, but there's always a chance. Mm. And I think now that I'm an older woman, there's less of a chance. So I have that freedom of, like, being older and my sexual invisibility increasing, which has a little bit of a freedom to it. I kind of enjoy that.
Right. So you have this important kind of note at the bottom of this map. It's a P.S. And you say, like, this is ridiculous, right? Can you read that part for us?
It says, P.S. We know this is all ridiculous, right? I should be able to run anywhere in a sports bra and short shorts, young or old, skinny or fat, with headphones, without worrying about being raped or murdered, much less harassed and assaulted.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the nature of this map was kind of meant to be sort of funny, like, you know, because I find it absurd, and absurd things are hilarious. But it's also, it's so frustrating, you know. And the thing that was really remarkable to me when this map came out, so, you know, all the women I've shown it to are like, yeah.
Yeah.
It's totally, this is like just walking, you know, because it's not necessarily like running. It's any time you're out alone. And then a friend of mine shared it, and then a male friend of hers shared it. Mm-hmm. And he got all of these comments and all of these reactions, all of these men saying, this is so sad. This is terrible. What does this say about our society? You know, and I'm just like, oh, my God, I'm shocked that they're shocked. Mm. Like, how did they not know? I think mostly it's because a lot of this stuff, we internalize it and we just do it because it's how we have to survive and how we've learned to survive. I mean, like, I've had close calls. Like, I've had, as a teenager, some man following me in his car, hiding in a driveway. I had to run across a field from a high school to get him to shake him from me. Mm-hmm. You know, I've had people, like, block me. I've had people pull over. I used to count the cars, pay attention in my small town, like, oh, I've seen that car pass me now 4 times. Mm-hmm. Like, I need to change my route, or I need to turn around, or, you know, like, I've figured out all these little survival tactics. Yeah. I'm not paranoid, you know, like, it's happening.
No, we internalize this kind of stuff. So it seems so obvious. What do you think, like, is that part of the release of putting this out in the world, even if you didn't really kind of intend that when you did it?
Yeah, I mean, I think with a lot of the maps that I create, it's about giving a voice to something that I don't feel like has a voice, you know, and it could be something silly or serious or a mixture of both, like this one is. You know, I wrote a blog post about this, and then that became my way of sort of expanding on this idea. And when I initially wrote it, I was thinking, this is just going to be me talking about it hitting a nerve with people and how unusual that was. But then as I was writing it, it turned into this expose sort of my experience as a woman, as a girl, like being a runner, and kind of the pain and the frustration of it, too. So I realized, like, how much more depth there was to this feeling of what, you know, the impetus behind creating this map in the first place.
Yeah.
It's like, it makes me angry that this is the reality, but it's also the reality and it's not going to change tomorrow. So I don't know, what else can we do but give a voice to it and not sort of gaslight ourselves all the time?
Mm-hmm.
Like, as soon as we make men aware and not like in an insistent, like, you need to see this, but just talk about it because this is reality.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. I'm joined now in studio by the show's Sam Dingman. Hey there, Sam.
Good morning. Mark, not to put you on the spot, but would you say you have a working definition of journalism?
Oh, that's a tough one. Maybe I'll just have to go with the old Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart definition of obscenity. I know it when I see it.
Okay. I will take that, especially since I think many journalists, if pressed, might have a hard time giving a quick, easy definition of whatever it is that we do. And I recently spoke to a fellow audio journalist about this. His name is Brian Reed. He worked for many years as a reporter and producer at This American Life. And in 2017, he created a podcast called S-Town. Now, I'm speaking personally here, but I think S-Town was kind of a Citizen Kane moment for podcasting. It's a serialized story that starts off as a true crime investigation, but then morphs into this very nuanced portrait of a guy named John B. McLemore, a closeted gay man trying, in his own mind, to save his community. S-Town was a smash hit. It was downloaded tens of millions of times. It won a Peabody Award. And Brian found himself jetting all over the world giving speeches about the project. And he was often asked the question that I just asked you. What is journalism? Back then, he told me, he had a ready answer.
For a long time, I believed that the definition of journalism to me was to reflect reality.
But then Brian's reality got upended. He got sued by the estate of John B. McLemore. And as part of the lawsuit, Brian found himself legally obligated to prove that S-Town qualified as journalism. Now, that suit was eventually settled, but the question haunted Brian. And now he has a new podcast, produced in partnership with KCRW, called Question Everything. And his goal, he told me, is to come up with a better definition of journalism.
You know, at the time when I got sued for S-Town in 2018, I was reporting my next podcast series, what would become the Trojan Horse Affair, with Serial and the New York Times. And I was co-reporting it with a journalism student named Hamza Syed. And from the very first week of us working together, we learned that he and I had very different ideas of how journalists should be going about their work and kind of our relationship to a story and whether we should be approaching it with detachment or passion. And, you know, we ended up erupting in kind of big debates about this from, again, like our first interviews. And then at the same time, I was dealing with this lawsuit from people I didn't know who were claiming that S-Town wasn't journalism. And so I found myself kind of defending the fact that my work was journalism to these outside opponents.
Yeah.
While debating the very nature of journalism and how it should be done with my closest collaborator at the time.
Yeah.
And then I just, you know, just like all of us, I think I just saw a widening distance between certain factions of our society over what constitutes truth.
Yeah. This is going to sound like kind of a touchy-feely question, but can I ask you what that felt like to wrestle with that in stream with trying to report?
You know, I did what I know to do, which is we put it in the story, you know, like
yeah.
We put the wrestling in the Trojan Horse Affair. We had a co-reported story between two journalists, kind of in the style of a buddy comedy with like, you know, me being the quote unquote old hand and Hamza being like the young buck or whatever, even though we're the same age. But anyway,
you're very much the Danny Glover in that scenario.
Yeah, I know. Exactly. And so all this to say, how did it feel? It felt crazy making and disorienting, honestly. Like it was really hard because you're telling a story but trying to tell a like meta subplot about the experience of telling the story that you're telling. You know,
yeah.
I had this feeling of like I don't know where my life ends and the story begins anymore.
Yes. Honestly. And That made me want to ask you, you know, in answering that question, you said, like, well, I did what I know to do, which is kind of put that debate in the story, like, when necessary, put yourself into the story. And where do you feel like for you, you found the idea that putting yourself into the story and letting that be a part of the storytelling was something that could be available to you? It's like a tool in your toolkit.
I can remember the very moment. I remember being in one of the first big group edits for S-Town. The way we do edits is like, well, you know, I'll write a draft, or, you know, whoever's the reporter will write a draft and we read them aloud. And people were talking about the first episode. And, you know, in the first episode, I talk about how I got contacted by a listener named John B. McLemore in Alabama, who, you know, said that he lived in a shit town and he wanted someone from our show to come investigate. And I end up going down to investigate, you know, how corrupt the place was, basically. And there was this, you know, the editors afterwards were like, why did Brian go down? Like that's kind of one of the questions they had from this round of the edits was they didn't understand why I actually, you know, went through with going down, what drew me there. And this like discussion ensued where I was kind of just sitting there and all of my colleagues were talking about like, what is Brian's character? Like, what is his motivation? Why is he going down? And like at one point I just had to lean in and be like, guys, I'm right here. I'm like a real person. I'm
you
right
can
here.
Ask me.
Yeah. And it was so bizarre to me. Like I did not think of myself as a character in that story going in. But it became clear to me that I was. There is something about this medium where as a listener, you're listening to someone in your ears for hours on end talk in depth about a story or a piece of reporting that they've devoted a long time to. And you just wonder about them as a person.
Yeah.
If they don't say why they did it, it's odd in our medium.
Yeah. Something I thought in listening to Question Everything was that it felt like, as I've come to know the character of Brian Reed through S-Town and Trojan Horse Affair and now Question Everything, it actually felt like there was quite a bit of continuity in terms of the amount of yourself that is going into the story. Because in S-Town, you answer that question of why did I go down there? And then there's also other moments that I remember people remarking at the time in conversations about the show, like there's the part where you pretend to take a hit of weed when you're with some sources who are smoking weed.
From a bowl made of deer antlers.
Yes.
That's just an important detail to remember.
Yes, anyway, lest we not forget.
Or elk antlers, maybe. That was clarified in the fact-checking. It might have been elk antlers. Anyway.
Yeah. And then obviously, as you said, you foreground the disagreement about the nature of journalism in Trojan Horse Affair, and then now Question Everything, you're really at the center of this. I mean, it is, as you say, it is your quest to understand this thing, and you're making yourself really vulnerable in doing so. The reason that's interesting to me in the context of what you said about our medium is I wondered how much of this kind of crisis of confidence about journalism has to do with the fact that S-Town arrived at such a moment when podcasting was exploding and the narrative potential of this medium was really becoming clear to people. And S-Town was such an intensive character study and was so novelistic in format. So in addition to the questions that would have been there anyway about the story, there was also all this attention on the medium more broadly. How much do you think that the question you're trying to answer was a product of the medium as well as the story itself that you were telling?
I think I would have arrived at some sort of crisis about journalism, even if S-Town had never happened. And the reason I say that is because as I've been digging into the reporting for this show, so many journalists are telling me that they're in deep crises of conscience or faith in the work. You know, I'm going to keep this kind of vague.
Sure. But no problem.
There's an email I got from someone I really respect who I was trying to, who I had an interview actually scheduled with this summer. Someone who's been in this field a long time, who wrote me a few days before the interview and said, I need to cancel the interview. I feel so lost and that we're living in such a time of radical uncertainty in our field, you know, both in, you know, having to do with journalism, media, democracy, facts.
Yeah.
I just don't know what to say in an interview. And that both was incredibly alarming and validating for the premise of the show. You know, like that's like saying like medicine is falling apart or something in America. Like there's something big happening in journalism right now.
So you've come to doubt your previous definition,
or of the mission statement. Is that because you feel
reflect
like...
Reflect reality. Yeah, I wonder if it's not enough. Like, I wonder if it's a bit of a cop-out to say all journalism should do is reflect reality. You know? Should we not try to strive for a better reality?
Well, more of that to come on Question Everything. Brian Reed is the host and executive producer. Brian, thank you so much.
Thanks, Sam. It's a pleasure.
Parts of Arizona are havens for stargazers with their dark skies and lack of light pollution. But are those dark skies really devoid of color? Our next guest argues they're, in fact, not. Rebecca Boyle is a science journalist and author. Her piece called What Color is Night was published in Atlas Obscura, where she's a columnist. I spoke with her earlier and asked what got her thinking about what color the night sky is.
Honestly, it was in part because I was planning a trip to Alaska, and I was hoping to see the northern lights, and I did. I got lucky. The sun's been very active lately, so it's been a good show, actually, in a lot of the U.S., not just in the northern latitudes. But I was wondering if I'd be able to see it, and in part because, you know, Alaska in the summer is very – there's the midnight sun, you know, depending on how far north you are.
Yeah.
It's not that dark. And there's this actually good chart you can look at on timeanddate.com, has a nice little like darkness chart. And there's a few other kind of scales that I look at as a stargazer to look at where is there a good dark sky that doesn't have light pollution, but also the sun itself in the northern latitudes in the summer can kind of get in the way. And you don't really have darkness overnight. You have what they call civil twilight or astronomical twilight, which are these kind of like grades of darkness. And it just made me kind of think about like, what does that actually mean? And like, it's not absent of color ever, really. And even when you're looking for a really dark sky, you know, you think of it as this blackness, but it's not. It's more complicated than that.
Right, which I think for a lot of people, myself included, when I was reading through your essay, it seemed so counterintuitive. Like, of course, if you go outside in the middle of the night, the sky is black, like there's no light. But as you write, that's not true.
Yeah, it's not true for how we experience it. It's not true just optically. It's not true for how animals experience it. And that's something I didn't even get into in this piece for Atlas Obscura, is that, you know, the experience that other creatures have of nighttime is very different from ours. And we wouldn't even think of it as that dark if you had the sensory capabilities of some nocturnal animals. But yeah, it's kind of counterintuitive. But if you go outside at night and look, you'll be like, oh yeah, it's not just blackness. It's not just this emptiness. There's a lot of color. There's a lot of vivid characters in the night sky and in the landscape around you. You know, almost anywhere you are in the U.S., it's not totally dark. And so there's always going to be some leakage of light from somewhere.
Are there ways that we can actually see that? Because, again, I think for a lot of people who go outside and look up at night, they're not going to see those colors. So is there a way that we can help ourselves to do that?
I think one of the most important things to do when you're outside at night is to just give yourself time. This is not something people think about necessarily if you're an amateur kind of stargazer. I want to go outside and look at some stars and like take a peek. You need to be out there for like 30 minutes at least.
Let your eyes adjust, really kind of thing.
Yeah, your eyes have to really adjust. You know, the rods and the cones have to really be able to receive this, as you know, many photons as they can, as your pupils dilate as widely as they can get. It takes a lot longer than you might think. Like 30 minutes is kind of a minimum for good seeing, is the term astronomers use to talk about what the sky looks like at night. You want to give yourself time. And the longer you're out there, the more you can adjust, the more features, the more color you might actually see in the night sky.
Is it easier to do that? And if so, this would seem somewhat ironic, in a place where there is less light, where it's sort of a darker sky, it's easier to see, for example, stars in the sky?
Yeah. I mean, the darker you are, the drier you are. I mean, the Phoenix area is a great place to be for a really dark and well, depending on where you are in Phoenix, I guess it can be pretty bright in the city. But, you know, in the Sonoran Desert and the deserts around Phoenix, it's really, really dark in certain areas. We can get away from city lights. The atmosphere is so dry that light domes are not quite as bad as they are in the Midwest and other places in the U.S. because there's just so little humidity in the desert to carry molecules of air that would bounce light around. So you're going to get darker in Phoenix, outside of Phoenix, you know, north towards Tucson, than you would somewhere like Chicago. You know, it takes a lot longer to get somewhere dark if you're in the Midwest. But yeah, the darker you can get, the better you'll see the detail in the night sky. And, you know, color itself kind of depends on the light around you, what time of night it is, how far after sunset you're outside, whether there are clouds overhead that can kind of reflect light back to the ground from the, you know, cities or from the sun itself, depending on what time of night it is. There's some like ancillary reflection that can happen after sunset. But then also just look at the stars themselves and you'll notice how much color there is in the stars. I mean, stars are not just like flecks of light. They're blue, they're red.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're yellow, depending on the type of star, their distance from us. All these different features kind of make them appear differently.
So have you been able to go out at night and really have the time to let your eyes adjust and see some of these colors?
I am lucky to live on a mountain in Colorado, so I have a very dark sky at my house and kind of in the part of the city that I'm in. And I kind of try to make a habit of it.
So I want to ask you kind of on a philosophical level, like obviously there's the science behind the fact that there is a lot of color in the night sky, but I'm wondering to you on a sort of philosophical level, what does it mean that when you go outside and it's dark out, it's not really entirely black? There is still color to be seen.
To me, it's just a reminder that we're on a planet. You know, you feel like you're in space at night sometimes. That's one thing I like about the night sky, is it's sort of this portal to the rest of the universe that's obscured during the day when the sun is out. You get to see this other world that exists beyond our world, but you're still never really separate from our world. You're in the atmosphere. You're on Earth, but you're within it in a very real sense. Like the atmosphere is what keeps us alive. It's what keeps us here. And because you're within that layer of this planet, the sky looks a certain way. It doesn't look the same on Mars. It doesn't look the same from the moon, because we have our atmosphere and all the attenuating effects that it has on our vision and our senses, the way the night sky feels, you know, on your skin. It's cooler at night, especially in the desert in Arizona. It's at night, it cools down. And that's when you can feel comfortable to go outside and do things. And you're feeling the atmosphere, you're feeling Earth, even as you're exposed to space. To me, that's what the night sky represents, is this connection to the rest of the universe, but this everlasting presence of our planet.
It sounds like it kind of puts some big things in perspective and context for you.
It always has. That's kind of my love of the night sky, is really about placing us in perspective. You know, it makes you realize how tiny you are and how tiny your problems are, and how grand the rest of the universe is that we're all connected to.
That is Rebecca Boyle, a science journalist based in Colorado. Rebecca, thank you so much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And that'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for listening. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a great rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here on Monday.